You've heard me talk about Morning Kick, used by former karate champion Chuck Norris. It's a daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes similar to strawberry lemonade, and I enjoy it. I know I don't eat as many vegetables as I should, but Morning Kick has helped me make up for that, and I feel great. I have more energy and better digestion. It's an easy part of my morning routine. My wife started taking it as well. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris today. And we are live right now on the Conversations That Matter podcast with pastors Sean McGowan and Zachary Garris, both PCA pastors. They explained what happened last year at the Presbyterian Church in America's annual meeting. They call their, what's it called again? General Conference? That's the Mormon thing. What do you guys call yours?
General Assembly.
General Assembly. I was close. So you're going to talk a little bit today for those who are listening who are in the PCA about what's going on. I know, Sean, you're also, I think it's worth mentioning, a trustee at Covenant College. And then Zach, you actually run the publishing company that I published my last book through. So people can check both of you out. If you go to Twitter, it's at Zachary Garris and at Irish Presby, at Irish Presby. If you want to check out Sean's stuff, anywhere else you want to send people?
Yeah, that's good.
All right. Well, let's jump into it then. I appreciate both of you guys. We've known each other, I guess, for years. I've actually met you now in person, Zach, and we spent some time together. Sean, that still needs to happen at some point. We need to connect face to face. But you guys were both together yourselves last week, I guess, so during the Southern Baptist Convention, I guess the PCA met. It's like every convention met that week or every denomination. And so you met together in, was it in Tennessee?
Memphis, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what happened?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll jump out first, Zach. I will say this, at least from my perspective, it was less contentious than probably the last two. Not as much tension in the room. It was the 50th anniversary of the Presbyterian Church in America. We began in 1973. There's a lot of celebration, a lot of things like that were going on. So it was a celebratory year. And there wasn't as much kind of, attention going on. So anyway, all that to say, it was pretty celebratory. Maybe one of the first things to talk about, one of the first things that happens is the election of a moderator every year. And it alternates between, a teaching elder and a ruling elder. So this year it was a teaching elder, a pastor, that would be the moderator. And moderators really, they don't give their own, personal opinions or anything like that. They really are there to make sure the meeting is run efficiently, proper procedures, good process, or good order. All of those things, but they do have some responsibilities. Like if there's a study committee that's formed, they appoint who's on it. If there's a commission, and that happened this year, they would appoint
who's on the commission. You okay with your audio there, Sean?
I think so. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. It sounded like something ran over your microphone for a second.
I apologize.
I may need to take over here.
No, I got it. I'm good. I don't have those cool headphones. So the thing that a moderator can do is they can appoint people to a study committee, or if there's a commission, and in this assembly, there was a commission appointed. So he will be the one to appoint that. And this year they elected teaching elder Fred Greco, of Christ Church from Katy, Texas. He did a great job. I mean, he knows how to run an efficient assembly, and it clearly showed. In fact, one point someone made a motion to ask if he could be moderator for life, and Greco responded rightly that it was out of order to ask that question. So, but it was good. So that was one of the first things. Maybe just some highlights of some broader topics. Some of the actions taken included issues revolving accountability. So there was one overture to basically hold some of our permanent agencies and committees of the assembly more accountable by making sure, you know, they're operating according to the desire of the assembly. So there was an overture that was basically trying to bring more accountability to our permanent committees and agencies. You think like Covenant College, Covenant Seminary, you know, our missions agencies, mission to North America, mission to the world. So trying to make sure that they are more accountable to the assembly. So that was, I think that was a good thing that passed.
John, let's say a quick word, just so people understand. Overtures are written by, a church would start it. If it goes through the presbytery, if they approve it, it goes up to the General Assembly. So it's requesting the General Assembly to do something. And so churches or even individual teaching elders, which are pastors, can also send them. So it's just part of our polity. Just so listeners understand exactly what an overture is. Because that's what we're going to discuss. We're going to discuss a variety of overtures here that were on the floor.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, thank you. So another thing, I think this probably was a big one as well, is just to explain it a little bit. There's something called RPR, which is the Review of Presbytery Records. And basically these are elders that are appointed by presbyteries to basically go for a few days and review presbytery records. Each presbytery is supposed to keep minutes, and those are reviewed by the higher court, which would be the assembly. And basically what they're looking for is there any, you know, irregularities? Sometimes there's exceptions of substance, which could be something like, you know, an ordination commission was not properly, there weren't enough people on it, or it wasn't executed properly, or something like that. So they look for those things. And this is where you start to really see if, make sure presbyteries are in accordance with our standards, right? Our confession, catechisms, and the Book of Church Order. And this year, RPR actually cited a recommended citing Metro New York Presbytery. Metro New York Presbytery is basically like, you know, around New York City, basically. I'm just going to read it. They recommended citing Metro New York Presbytery with an exception of substance, which would require them to respond to next year's assembly to this concern. But also they recommended referring this matter to the SJC for a possible censure. And the issue was that a congregation in Metro New York Presbytery invited a woman to preach on the Lord's Day.
Oh my, so this is the same issue that the Southern Baptists and some other denominations are dealing with.
Yeah. So what they did was that they called it a Bible study. It wasn't a proclamation of the word. It was a Bible study, which added further kind of headache to it, because basically what they were saying was that the word was not proclaimed, but then the sacrament of the Lord's Supper was administered.
I am saddened by this, by the way. That's not why I'm wiping my eye right now. Just for some reason, my eyes, something irritated it. So I just wanted to explain that. But it looks to everyone else like I'm weeping over this this degradation of the pulpit in New York City.
Sean, we should mention, I think there were also some weeks Sundays where this church had no preaching and still had the Lord's Supper.
Yeah, that's right.
So you had multiple offenses, but this was a woman. I think she's a well-known woman. Episcopalian pastor, Fleming Rutledge, I think is her name.
Oh, Fleming Rutledge. I know who that is.
Yeah, from
she's
Virginia.
Way out there.
So yeah. She went to this church in New York. They had her preach. And I guess they even posted it on their website initially as a sermon, and then they corrected it. So the problem here is the presbytery didn't do anything. They didn't. They should have disciplined the church, and they didn't. And so that's why the RPR, Review of Presbytery Records, is citing the presbytery. And it's so egregious that they recommended it to the General Assembly, which just met, to send it to the SJC, which is the Standing Judicial Committee. It's a commission. It's essentially was created. It's like the Supreme Court of the PCA. It was created in the 90s, I think. And so they're going to hear the case, and they're, you know, probably going to discipline the presbytery in some capacity. Yeah.
So they're a commission. They can act. They basically stand in place of the whole assembly, basically hearing the trial. I mean, instead of, you know, 2,200 commissioners, you know, listening to a case or something like that, they appoint, I forgot how many are on there, but they appoint
like
men.
20 something.
Yeah, they appoint men that basically represent the assembly and can act for the assembly as a commission. So this is going to go before the assembly, and it will be a trial. And the presbytery will be able to defend themselves, and then there'll be a decision made, and presumably some censure will come down. I have heard, and I'm not trying to, you know, spread false information, but I have heard that this church may be looking to leave the PCA. So if that happens and they're no longer under the presbytery's jurisdiction, I don't know what can really come about, but.
Yeah, they had Fleming Rutledge there. I'm surprised they're even in the PCA, to be honest.
Well, so. you have had churches leave the PCA that have wanted women pastors, preachers, whatever. You know, that happens.
I mean, she's a feminist theologian, though. I mean, I think she's done commentaries on various books of the Bible. But I just remember from years ago, Southeastern had Michael Byrd. You know who Michael Byrd is? And he was telling Walter Strickland in this podcast at Southeastern that he makes all his students read Fleming Rutledge because they need the womanist perspective. And I'm like, who's this Fleming Rutledge? And I started looking into her, and I'm like, oh, my goodness, she's way out there. So all that to say, that's PCUSA territory, I think you're getting close to once you start doing that.
Episcopalian? Yeah, that's pretty liberal, usually.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think looking at this in my mind is like, it's, you know what? I mean, this is how our system works. I mean, this is a good thing. It was cited. It was caught by the RPR, Review of Presbytery Records, and it's going through the process that it should. It's going to be recommended to the Standing Judicial Commission, and there'll be a trial and possible censure. What that will be, you know, we don't know yet, but this is good. I mean, this is how our polity works, and I think it will be for the benefit of the church. So,
is it like the SBC where there's supposedly numerous churches that they say, I think close to 2,000, but there's all these churches that are having women preach at various times or have women on staff who are pastors, and then Saddleback becomes like the example or the test case. Is it like that, or is this just really a fluke?
No, this does happen some. I don't think this is the only example. I've heard of other churches, as I, you know, alluded to, that have already left over, you know, they had a woman preacher, and one church was brought up on charges by the presbytery, and then the church left. So, I mean, that's good, though, is, you know, we're saying, hey, you don't belong in the PCA. That's not our rules. And you can go join, you know, the EPC or ECHO or one of these, you know, egalitarian denominations.
Right.
And you're welcome to do that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Was this the first PCA meeting without Greg Johnson?
Yeah, this was. Yeah. There's been a few high profile guys that are no longer in the PCA, or were certainly at the very least not at this assembly. But yeah, this is the first one since Johnson and Memorial has left the PCA.
And no Keller either. This is the first one without him, right?
Well, he from at least. I have not seen him at the assemblies I've been at. I don't think he's attended the last few because of his
health issues,
health issues and things like that. But certainly one where he's not, you know, he's either not, you know, broadcasted on the screen and gives a message or something like that, like he did the year prior.
So who leads the if you would, the more progressive, for lack of a better term, wing of the PCA, the national partnership? Is that Scott Sauls? Who's behind that? Now,
Sauls is, I believe, was involved with the national partnership. A lot of the maybe more progressive leaders aren't that well known, frankly, I think is probably how I would put it.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So, but their presence is still there then. They haven't been routed because Keller's not around and Greg Johnson isn't there anymore. And not that Keller was never part of the, just so everyone knows, he was never part, as far as I know, of that national partnership. But he's identifiably, right, though, one of the people who did help push things kind of to the left.
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly more progressive minded people within the PCA, you know, but it, I mean, they have, obviously there's some groups, but sometimes it's just along ideologies and just different views of, I mean, some of the things we'll get into here, like, you know, deaconesses or things like that, which Keller did, you know, push, but.
I would say, John, that, it, you know, from my experience, and it's limited, my attendance at GA, but I would say that there's been a conservative trajectory over the last few years, where if you go back to the, you know, 2010 onward to 2019, I mean, there was clearly more of a progressive presence. I mean, even watching this interview, if you weren't there, you could see that. And it seems to me that, you know, there's a lot more young, conservative minded men in the PCA that are coming through the ranks. And I mean, quite frankly, you know, I think a lot more ruling elder involvement, that is pushing the assembly in a more conservative direction, I think. So it seems.
And so people understand the difference between teaching and ruling. The ruling elders haven't necessarily gone to seminary. They're not the paid on staff preaching every week pastors, right?
They're lay elders in a sense. Right. So just a brief word there. The PCA comes out of the Southern Presbyterian Church, which held to two office view, which is that there's just elders and deacons, but that there's a distinction within the office of elder, or two orders, sometimes they call it. So you have the teaching elder, which is often called a pastor, and then the ruling elders. So they're all elders. They all are on the session and vote. the pastor, the teaching elder is usually the moderator. So they all rule, but one focuses on teaching. So that's 1 Timothy 5:17. I got to defend the two office polity a little bit there, but the Northern Church, like the OPC, I think they're three office in practice. So we're a little bit different there.
Someone does ask, what is the national partnership? So I just kind of threw that out there for the uninitiated. Isn't that kind of like an email chain, for lack of a better term for it, that it's a network that basically formed around this email chain, and they tend to push things more in the progressive direction?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think they were a little more formal than that in some capacity, but the email thing was more secretive. And then that came up, you know, more in the open a couple years ago. Right. Yeah. And right, as far as like who to vote for and things like that. And so that was kind of, an end to that. Yeah.
Yeah. There was, you know, I don't know too much if there was more, I don't know if there were, you know, group chats and things like that going on during the assembly, but they certainly had an email chain where they were pushing, you know, more of a progressive agenda. They were giving recommendations on who to vote for. You know, at times maybe saying not so nice things about the other candidate, the more conservative one. You know, there was stuff that came out in those emails where they were calling certain presbyteries national partnership presbyteries, trying to gain more men to come into the fold that were in those presbyteries, so you could have, you know, the majority of your presbytery in the national partnership. So there was this really this caucusing to get certain things, you know, implemented in the PCA. But after that email leak, I mean, I think it really depleted the whole national partnership movement. So it's not to say that there aren't, you know, progressively minded men, but that push has certainly, I think, waned a little bit because of that exposure.
And just so people understand the polity, we have the individual churches and they have a session and we, you know, with their elders. Then you have a presbytery, which is like a regional body and of churches, and the teaching elders or pastors are actually members of the presbytery, not of their churches. And then above that you have the General Assembly. We don't have synods, which would be in between. And so that's why it's kind of like this federal system, you know, where you have the presbyteries are kind of like states, and so they can differ some in their practices. You know, if that helps, analogy helps kind of make sense of Presbyterianism.
Yeah, every time we have you on for this summary of what happened, we'll probably have to re-explain all that for everyone. Just
that's all right. It's good.
Zach is our translator. It's all good.
All right. So I think there's more that you wanted to share, right?
Let me move on with some of this quick stuff. Like, you know, we have nominations every year, and those are important, where we nominate men to permanent agencies and committees. I can't, you know, stress the importance of having good, you know, solid men on these agencies and committees, because they really, in many ways, they're the face of the denomination. So, you know, we want to put good men on, you know, boards. We want to put good men on the committees and the agencies. So, we have a nominating committee every year that nominates, men that are recommended from their presbyteries. And I think overall this year it was a good nominating season, and there were good men that were elected to our committees and agencies. So that's good news, I think, all the way around. Couple things about the sexuality issues. There were a few overtures that were passed by the assembly from last year that asked to amend the BCO, our Book of Church Order, to include more qualifications for officers in the church. And remember from last year, I said those had to get approval from at least 2/3 of the presbyteries, and then they would be voted again. They would be voted on again by this year's General Assembly.
Right.
Which only needs 50%, by the way. Right, so yeah. Assembly 50%, presbyteries 2/3, and then back to the assembly for 50%.
Right.
Let's point out Overture 15, which we discussed last year, failed.
Right.
Which was very specific on basically forbidding an officer describing himself, is that right? Describing himself as a homosexual.
Right.
So that failed, you know, and there are different arguments against it or whatever. But these overtures with broader language, which Sean can tell us about, they passed, and they passed, I think, pretty overwhelmingly.
Yeah. Let me just read. So the first one was Overture 29. It was to amend BCO Chapter 16. By adding 16.4 regarding qualifications for church office. Okay, these are the officers of the church, and this is what passed. Officers in the Presbyterian Church in America must be above reproach in their walk and Christ-like in their character. While office bearers will see spiritual perfection only in glory, they will continue in this life to confess and to mortify remaining sins in light of God's work of progressive sanctification. Therefore, to be qualified for office, they must affirm the sinfulness of fallen desires, the reality and hope of progressive sanctification, and be committed to the pursuit of spirit-empowered victory over their sinful temptations, inclinations, and actions. So when the stated clerk tallied all the presbyteries, and some of them, you know, at least when he tallies them, don't get their votes in, but the stated clerk reported that 79 presbyteries passed that, and only one voted against it. And it was approved at this year's General Assembly almost unanimously. So that will actually be now put into our Book of Church Order. There was another one, Overture 31. I don't have the language. I'm sorry. But it was basically amending BCO 21 and 24 regarding qualifications for ordination. So the first one was regarding qualifications for church officers. And the other one was regarding ordination or the ordination process and the examination of an ordination candidate. And that passed 77-3 in the presbyteries. And it was again voted on this year and passed almost unanimously by the assembly. So that will be put into our BCO as well. So those were two from last year. And then this year there was one, Overture 23, and that's to amend BCO 8.2 and 9.3. And it essentially speaks to the sexual purity and chastity of church officers. And this is what the language says. It requires officers, both elder and deacon, to conform to the biblical requirement of chastity and sexual purity in his description of himself. Am I still here? Did I lose y'all?
Yeah, you're there. You're there. Okay. I was just you were making such good points. I didn't want people to be distracted by Zach and my faces.
You get the whole screen, Sean.
Hey, man, I'll take it. All right. So I'll go back. It requires officers, both elder and deacon, to conform to the biblical requirement of chastity and sexual purity. In his description of himself, his convictions, his character, and his conduct. And that passed this year's assembly with the vote of 1673 to 223. So that now goes to the presbyteries for a vote. So, and of course, the implication of that would be that church officers must communicate their struggle with sin within biblical categories. But, you know, again, this all goes back to the question of I think enough is there. But the question of will sessions and presbyteries implement these things is a different question, quite frankly.
So the more narrow language of, you know, forbidding an officer from describing or identifying himself as homosexual, we don't have that language in our BCO. I mean, I think our standards, Westminster Larger Catechism, would apply there, but we don't have that in our standards to deal with side B, but the hope is that this sufficiently does because of this language of his description of himself, right? So I would hope this could be used if an officer was saying, I'm a gay Christian or a homosexual Christian or whatever, that we could use this and discipline him.
Or disqualify him from...
Right. Well, right. That I call him to repentance, and then if he doesn't,
We were talking off camera about this a little with the PCA. It seems like that's been the major struggle, the one that's taken the headlines over the last, I don't know, 5 years, is this side B theology, revoice, soft pedaling homosexuality as this orientation that's not innately sinful that you can participate in, but you can't take a physical action in, but you can participate in the sense of having attractions and that kind of thing. So this has been condemned, and it seems like at least for the last three or two PCAs, the two before this, there were overtures passed that did provide that stronger language to condemn that kind of thing. And then it goes to get approved by the presbyteries, and it seems like they don't pass. They don't make it, but they'll make it at the General Assembly. So, do you feel like, I guess, progress was made, even though you didn't get the more aggressive language this year?
Yeah. I mean, I think this one obviously still has to go to the presbyteries. I don't foresee too many problems. I mean, this was a crushing vote in favor of it. I don't think it should be very controversial. And it does seem some men voting against some of these other overtures, they just really have a problem of putting specific, you know, condemning a specific sin in the BCO. And so they like a little bit of this broader language. Now, I guess in some sense, this might actually even be more useful because people are creative in some of the bad things they do. So, you know, like who was describing themselves as a gay Christian, you know, 20 years ago? I don't know. So some of this broad language might actually be useful.
Yeah, I mean, now they say same-sex attracted. The language keeps shifting.
Right.
They don't even say gay Christian anymore. It's basically the same thing, though. All right, so you're positive about that. It sounds like, I mean, you've voted for accountability, for disciplining this church that had a woman come and preach, and then or at least that's in process of potentially going into effect. And then you have these qualifications come through.
Can I just say one thing about the, I'm sure, well, I won't say that. I'll just say this, you know, the debate around the RPR and having Metro New York go to the stand before the SJC was not a debate that people stood up and said, well, we think, you know, women should be preaching and we need to change our polity and all this stuff. The people that spoke out against it were saying, actually, we should allow the presbytery to to take action first before we go to the before they go to the SJC. Give them an opportunity to you know handle this on their own, you know, figure this out and discipline the way they need to. The argument against that was, well, the Presbytery already had an opportunity and they failed to adequately discipline. So that was really what the debate was around. The debate wasn't around the merits of a woman preaching as if that's a, you know, that's a good thing or we right. should have more of that or something like that. So that should give you some insight about what, you know, where there was pushback.
So in other words, a majority of the assembly voted that this was such an egregious violation or failure on the Presbytery's part to discipline this, that they that this the Presbytery should go straight to the SJC.
Yeah, right.
And be disciplined. So, okay. Yeah, I mean, that's that just shows you, you know, that was a good move, I think, by the Presbytery. But you can see why there would be some opposition to that.
So you pretty much would say that the more conservative wing got everything they wanted, maybe with the exception of just a little stronger language on the revoice stuff.
Well, if, as far as the assembly goes, no, we got, I mean, I don't think there was anything that went poorly. This was, okay. This was kind of the, I think, you know, there's back and forth on how to craft the overture addressing the side B stuff. And this is what, you know, the overtures committee, they had a few options before them and they decided this is the one they wanted to go with. So this is supposed to be the best is the consensus. So,
yeah,
but there are other things we can discuss here. But go ahead, John.
Yeah.
If that passes though, that's the first, like, so this would be the governing, I guess, language that would then can be used potentially to discipline churches who are in that revoice theology camp.
Well, no, go ahead. We passed the one we mentioned, Overture 29, that was from last year. So when the assembly voted in favor of that this year, that's going into the BCO. Mm-hmm. So that is good. It's requiring, you know, progressive sanctification and some of these things. So, actually, that could be used against side B, but with the GA, the General Assembly, saying we still want another overture on description.
So we're still
trying another one. Yeah.
So the way it works, when you vote on it there, it goes to the presbyteries for ratification, and then it comes back to you the next year to vote on again?
Yes.
So you vote on it twice?
Confirm it. Yep, yeah. Exactly.
Okay. No wonder things move slow.
So the first two that I read have already passed. They're going into our Book of Church Order, and they can be used now. So the last one that I read about, you know, the chastity, and in his description of himself, his convictions, character, and conduct, they need to conform to the biblical requirement of chastity and sexual purity. That was a new one voted on for the first time this year. And now is going to the presbyteries. But so I think if we have this one, I mean, you know, again, I'm one of those guys that thinks we have everything already we need in our standards, the confession, the catechisms, and our BCO. But I don't mind, you know, refining it and making it more particular and stronger, since clearly we, you know, we need to. So, but I think, yeah, I think this is a good trajectory for sure.
So it sounds like BCA is much healthier than the SBC as far as.
Yeah, I think that way,
given what happened at the with the SBC and everything that's going on. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. That's interesting to me because I thought, if you go back 7 years, 5 years, whatever, when Greg Johnson was starting his stuff and, it just seemed to me like it was so slow, the reaction to it. And it seems so obvious. He's out now, and now there's language that addresses that subject. But so you part of this, though, is what you're saying is that it's just the way Presbyterians are. It takes a long time to get when there's a new threat, you can't immediately respond to it, at least on the level that you need to as far as putting language into your governing documents and so forth.
Yeah. I would say also, though, that the whole Greg Johnson situation woke a lot of people up and drove more people to be more active, you know, in their churches and their presbyteries and in the General Assembly. And I think just the growth of a lot of or the introduction of a lot of new, young, conservative confessional ministers that have come into the PCA in the last few years. I think all of that is included in kind of where it is today.
What do you attribute that to? The more younger ones that seem to be more conservative.
What do you think, Zach? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think maybe it's some of it's a generational thing. What we've grown up with, a little more hostile culture. And I think maybe some of the younger ministers just have responded to it in a firm way. I don't know. Maybe some of the seminary education. I think Greenville Seminary has been growing, and they're firmly confessional, solid place. So, yeah.
I think there's a growing love for for the confession too. And, a lot of young guys are, love the confession and believe that it's a summary. It's a faithful summary of what the scripture teaches. And, they recognize that our church is a confessional church and want to make sure that we maintain fidelity to that.
Maybe historical retrieval, Sean, where, I think more people are reading, the Puritans. I mean, the Westminster Assembly was essentially a Puritan body. So reading the Puritans, reading the Reformers, and so those guys were pretty conservative.
Correlating to this, you're having a lot more reproductions of older works too that mm-hmm. people are getting their hands on, like with Reformation Heritage books and some of those places that are reproducing a lot of these wonderful, rich Puritan works and even some old old Presbyterian works and things like that. I think a lot of those things are contributing to it. So you're seeing a lot of you're seeing a lot of those men that are steeped in those things, younger men, that are coming in, being ordained, and they're having a say at the assembly and in their presbyteries.
Yeah, I'm encouraged by that across denominations. I was actually with some Lutherans a few weeks ago, and there's some young Lutherans who, same thing. Their Missouri Synod's not exactly controlled by conservatives. They would all say they're conservative, but there's if you want to say authentically conservative people or based people who are younger want to have influence, exert influence, and they're not afraid of power as much. It seems like and I think what you just said about reading older guys, that's just more, I'm hearing more and more of that. Stephen was telling me, Stephen Wolf, and he is in the PCA, a few weeks ago, that he thinks younger guys are rediscovering kind of this scholastic tradition, the Reformers. They're now applying those things to the present situations. And it's like we went through almost like a dark ages that we didn't realize we went through, where we were, I don't know if this applies to the PCA as much, but I know in Baptist circles and in broadly evangelical circles, it seems like people just weren't interested in applying, let's say something like even what's the role of the civil magistrate, applying the rich tradition we have to that. It's like, we have soteriology, Calvinism, and maybe, we have things on eschatology and baptism, and that's about it, right? All the other stuff that these people wrote about didn't really matter. And now that we're asking all these questions, political and social questions, it seems like younger people are now finding this old gold. I hope that trend continues. I really do.
Amen. Amen.
Yeah. You guys are kind of at the forefront of that. In the PCA, at least.
Yeah. Well, we're pretty young. Wouldn't you say, Zach?
I'd like to think so.
You're not very restless, though. So.
Yeah. No, I don't like. I don't like that whole title.
No. Well, let me move on really quick. The next category is of abuse, and I think, John, you remember last year I was talking about the DASA report, the study report that came out of the PCA, and I said more than likely you'll see some overtures.
Rachel Den Hollander, right?
Yeah, she was part of that. And you'll more than likely, because remember, study reports are not binding on the churches. But sometimes people take from those study reports and say, this would be good to implement So we're going to send an overture up to implement this aspect of the study report or this recommendation or something like that. So we had a few of those. Let me just mention something, though, that we approved last year. Abuse victim protection provision. And basically what this said, this was a change in our BCO to say an accuser does not have to testify before the accused. In our polity, if someone makes an accusation, they have to testify. The accused does not have to testify. They can if they want to, but they don't have to. But some of the concerns was about, you know, situations of abuse. If you have someone that's accusing another person of you know, gross abuse or something like that, then they don't right now, as it's changed, they don't have to testify in front of the accused abuser. So whether that's, you know, they testify via Zoom or something like that, and they don't have to see the accused abuser, whatever it is, that was approved by the Presbytery 77-3, and it was passed almost unanimously by this GA that just passed. So now that is going to go into our BCO. I think this highlights something, though. I haven't really seen it talked about on social media. You know, but a lot of the stuff on social media now is talking about, you know, the PCA doesn't care about protecting abuse victims and things like that. Well, we just did something that protected abuse victims or potential abuse victims, right? The ones that are claiming abuse in a trial by not having them have to go through, you know, pain or trauma of having to stand in front of their accused abuser and testify. So the PCA just sought to protect abuse victims by not having them go through that process.
And so here's the thing is there were a few other overtures that related to this DASA report, abuse and whatnot, or, you know, some would say they were aimed issues of abuse, and there's four of them, I think, and they failed. Most of them didn't, or none of them were recommended by the overtures committee. There was a minority report for one of them, which was to allow atheists to testify in our courts. So we should discuss that because it's interesting.
I just bring that one up to show, you know, we did do something to protect abuse victims.
So here's what I was going to say, Sean, is unfortunately, this is the way our world works now. When an assembly does a lot of, you know, conservative things, maybe turns down some progressive proposals, more progressive, there's some media out there or people that are going to slander our denomination. And, you know, as if we don't care about abuse. I saw some headlines, you know, related to this, and that's just, it's just false. And it's frankly ridiculous. You don't have to like everything the PCA does. That's fine, but don't act like we don't care about abuse or don't take it seriously. That's just not true. There's not, you know, I'm sure there's abuse that happens in the PCA, gets hopefully dealt with all the time. But you know, let's not act like there's all of this secret abuse going on. And, you know, we have all these terrible ministers in our denomination. That's just slanderous.
Yeah, I just Googled it. Yeah. There's
there you go.
Today, the Presbyterian Church in America has an abuse crisis, too. Mm-hmm. Women thought the PCA was with its robust system of governance. Is it robust? Is that the might provide some accountability? They found that was not the case. So, yeah, they're pretty down on you guys.
Well, I'm down on them too. So
yeah. Well, that's, I mean, this is not a secular, you know, maybe now it is a secular media.
Going back to what Zach said, the thing that frustrates me is that, you know, there with any overture, there are a whole host of reasons why people don't vote for it.
Right.
And there's plenty of reasons. I can think of the main two that were brought up, atheist testifying. And then there was another one as well. I can think of a few reasons why good men didn't vote for it. And I promise you, it wasn't because they want abuse to prosper in the PCA. It's absurd and it's childish. And it's quite frankly beneath, in my mind, that of a Christian to say those things about other Christians, that we don't care about abuse or abuse victims.
I mean, the atheist testifying in our courts overture, there was a minority report put forth for that. And just the way the PCA works, we actually allow people to testify in PCA courts as long as they either believe in God or eternal judgment.
Believe in a system of rewards and punishments.
Right, right. So judgment. So you know, it doesn't even describe everybody. I mean, you could, I guess, have some false religion and you still believe in rewards and punishments, and you you could testify. And you know, this, John, you probably know this goes somewhat back to the civil courts. I mean, this was changed, I think, by the Supreme Court in the 60s. And, you know, the basis there is people who don't believe in eternal judgment are not fit to swear an oath and testify. They're not trustworthy. And, right. And so these are people that are publicly saying they don't believe in these things. So it's not just, you know, a practical atheist or something like that. So let me read our confession. This is Westminster Confession of Faith 22.3. Speaking of oaths, we actually have a whole chapter on this stuff. Whosoever taketh an oath ought duly to consider the weightiness of so solemn an act, and therein to avouch nothing but what he is fully persuaded is the truth. So, you know, you just think of that language for someone to take an oath and to swear that they're going to tell the truth. I mean, if they don't believe in God or judgment of some sort, then, you know, what good is an oath? And so, right. So that's just part of the, I mean, that was one of the main arguments, I think, against changing this and just sticking with what we had. It has nothing to do with not wanting abuse to be properly taken care of. So,
well, and you know, yeah. And another argument was, you know, if you have someone that has committed gross, sexual abuse or child molestation or anything like that, they're going to be caught up in the criminal courts, and they will hear, you know, they will get, you know, evidence, they will get, you know, rape kits or things like that, whatever it is. And they will hear different testimony, even from atheists. So, you know, this, and again, the criminal courts, the secular, civil magistrate, can back it up by threats of perjury. If you lie, right, we have the sword and we can actually hold you to that. Whereas in church courts, we don't have that. We don't have any way to keep them from lying or giving false information. So the idea that justice will not be met or justice will not be done because the Presbyterian Church in America does not allow a tiny fraction of people, atheists, to testify in its courts, I think doesn't take into account civil courts. And ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, doesn't take into account that even if justice isn't met in this life, there is ultimate justice in the hands of God. So, you know, we're not omniscient. We cannot right every wrong in this world, but we know at the end of the day that those who get away with horrific crimes will be dealt with in the hands of a just and holy God.
This is also the historic practice of the PCA and a lot of other churches, and nobody even had examples of where this would matter to change. So it just doesn't seem worth changing.
Right.
What do you think the trajectory is on, if there is a trajectory at all, on this abuse stuff? Do you think that there's going to be changes in the future on this? Do you think people will respond to the pressure that's being imposed?
I think I know that there's, you know, they're going to try to bring this back again. And I know good men that voted in favor of allowing atheists to testify. This wasn't at least in my conversations, this wasn't like a conservative progressive split. You know, there were good men that voted in favor of allowing.
Right. I'm talking more broadly. I'm saying more broadly with the Me Too kind of agenda. Do you see it making its way in the future into the PCA since you had Den Hollander there last year? I guess she wasn't there this year. I don't know. It seems to be the pressure that's being exerted, right? So a few years ago, the pressure was more on, you know, you're not being affirming of LGBT. Now the pressure seems to be this.
I mean, the thing is, if they come up with a good proposal to change our rules, where there's, you know, something could be improved upon and you persuade the assembly and the presbyteries of it, then I'm sure we would pass it. But these just weren't good enough proposals. I mean, that's just the way it is. And so I think part of it is the PCA has a pretty good BCO, Book of Church Order. And we have church courts. We've been dealing with these things, you know, the church, its entire history. So, maybe there'll be some more.
I'm going to bring in, Sean Graham, guys, who was at the meeting this year. Did you guys get to meet Sean?
I don't think so. Hi, Sean.
All right.
Good to meet you.
Sean's
guys.
A Baptist. And so, Sean, I'm having trouble with these two Presbyterians because they don't seem to want to like sling any mud on anyone or say anything that's not measured. And they're using their NPR library voices. So, Sean, please slam all the bad guys right now for us.
I don't even have a collar on my shirt. I'm not even sure how I can talk to Presbyterians right now because I can't put a bow tie on. This is crazy. It was really – I will tell you this, guys. Y'all have a much more enjoyable environment than I could have ever anticipated. You guys are welcoming. The pleasantry and the willingness of all the Presbyterian people just to explain everything, because there's a lot of technical stuff there. As a Baptist, we don't have your book of rules and your remote controls for voting and all the stuff y'all have. It was amazing to watch how orderly and pleasant it was. And I came away very impressed with the entire, with everybody I met there, even with all the tattoos and everything else. It was great to hang out with everybody.
Tattoos? What?
Oh, yeah. They're good Presbyterians.
Oh, okay. All right.
appreciate your kind words, brother.
Yeah. Well, Sean, I did not get to meet a whole lot of. I was there representing. I was working with our radio station with Bot Radio, and you know we had a booth there. Got to meet so many people coming by, and I got to sit in on some of the sessions and watch the discussion. I don't know if y'all discussed the RUF the debate over that issue as y'all were putting that through the processes, and. It was fun to watch y'all go back and forth, and there's these. I mean, it's regimented. It's really the best way to say it. Your debates and your arguments are regimented. They're clear and they're thoughtful. Whereas with the SBC, we're just screaming as we go to grab a microphone from somebody. So it's a different tone, a different tenor. It's refreshing. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Sean. Thanks for trying to convert all the Baptists who are watching to join the
PCA. I am one, but I gotta say it was good.
Good.
John, will you be there next year, brother?
I don't. If it was in Memphis, I could say yes. That was the reason I was there. It's because it's here in Memphis this year. So it was good in that, but it was. We as Southern Baptists, we're really good at. Just getting down the mud and wrestling with hogs. Y'all aren't good at that. So we're going to have to work on that and teach y'all how to really get dirty, leave your bow ties at home, and, let's take it down the aisle a little bit here. Let's work this thing out so everybody can talk about it, because there's nothing really newsworthy when you get done. I mean, there's no name-calling. Very disappointing. Is that better? Is that better, John?
Thanks, Sean. That's what I needed. Thank you. All right. Hey, cool. I'll see you later, brother. Thank you.
All right, buddy. Good to talk to you guys.
All right, so there's the Baptist perspective on what happened.
Great perspective, brother, I must say. That's great.
Okay. So you concur. All right, so, I mean, it sounds like everything was pretty much positive, all the developments, just about. I mean, this was a route for the conservatives. I think one of you texted me that this was a decisive, I guess, victory, if you really want to think about it that way. So, I mean, going forward, do you expect a backlash at all? Do you think the trajectory is going to continue this way? What can you tell people who are members of the PCA and encouraged by this? And, how do you capitalize on it?
I don't know. I can't really see into the future what will happen. I think that the trajectory is good. I would just strongly encourage. We did this last year. I mean, if you are a member of a PCA church, get involved, we aren't, the church doesn't stop in our polity. The church doesn't stop with the local church. Your pastor is a member of a presbytery. Your church is a member of a presbytery. And there's things that go on there, and there's things that go on at the General Assembly. Get involved, know what goes on. If your pastor has a, you know, an update. I hope your pastor gives a General Assembly update. You know, go to it and ask questions. I don't even think it's wrong to ask your pastor how he votes on certain things. You know, get to know them and know what goes on and speak to issues that are concerning to you. It doesn't mean you'll agree with everything your pastor does, you know, and I think, you know, you want to have grace. Don't, you know, respect that there might be differences, but on the big issues, you know, it's good to know where he lands and just be involved.
Good word. Zach, you got anything?
Yeah, I mean, who knows the future? I won't comment on it.
You're feeling good about the momentum right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was a really good assembly. There's actually two other things we can discuss. There was an overture on addressing titles. That's probably the one that's going to be controversial this year.
Wait. We haven't talked about the controversial one yet. You've been saving that.
So no, we actually have two. We have two more. Yeah. And then, yeah.
All right. Spit it out. Tell me.
Let's just jump in. So this is Overture 26. It would amend BCO 7-3 to prohibit the titles of pastor, elder, or deacon for those who are not ordained. So in other words, if you're if you're on staff at a church, but you're not actually a teaching elder or pastor, you shouldn't be given the title pastor. And the other one, this probably applies to, is deacon. And that's kind of the more explosive issue is the PCA, just to be clear, there are some Presbyterian denominations that ordain women deacons, like they hold office. The PCA does not. The PCA only has male officers. So only men can be teaching and ruling elders, and only men can be deacons. Now, there's been some, I guess in practice, this has been somewhat messy in the PCA. I'm not aware of any churches trying to ordain women deacons, but some churches do call their women deacons. And this can get a little complicated. Because I'm going to distinguish between deacon and deaconess. Okay, so where this has gotten messy is some churches have commissioned female deacons. So they'll commission them, or I guess they usually call them deaconesses. Tim Keller did that. He commissioned deaconesses, not ordained them. But then he even stopped laying hands on the men deacons that they ordained, which I think that was a BCO problem. But so in practice, there are people in the PCA who want to ordain women as deacons. That view is definitely held. But where it ends up a little messy is the practice. So you might go to a church's website and they'll list all their deacons, and they might have men and women both listed in there, even though the women are not ordained. So then you're like, well, who are their officers here? And so the practice is some of them just stopped ordaining their men at all, and they commission the men and women as deacons, which I think is a problem. There's some that ordain their men but commission women as deaconesses. They call them that, but they still list them under deacons. So let me read the overture says the exact language is, furthermore, unordained people shall not be referred to as or given the titles connected to the ecclesial offices of pastor, elder, or deacon. And so I think one thing to point out is that this does not address churches using the label deaconess. In fact, so this is where it gets a little complicated. The PCA allows, although it limits the office of deacon to men, it does allow the session to appoint assistants to the deacons. And those can be men or women, it says. And so what some churches do is they have women appointed assistants, diaconal assistants, and they call them deaconesses. So they're not really violating the BCO at all, I don't think. though I think it's confusing, and I think we probably shouldn't do that, use the language of deaconess. Because then what do you call the male assistants? They don't get a title. But you can see how this gets confusing, right? And I think there's definitely some churches working around the BCO. And so the practice is messy. And that's what this overture, I believe, is aimed at, trying to get churches to stop calling women diaconal assistants deacons, as if they hold office when they don't and they're not ordained. So
can you use the term deaconess or not?
Yes. My understanding is even with this overture, you could still use the term deaconess for your diaconal assistants, okay, who are women.
It's just confusing. You're right. It's just confusing and not helpful because it might, some people might perceive, okay, does the PCA have deaconesses? Because some do, but technically the office of deacon is only reserved for men. So technically they could have that, but it just confuses things for people that are questioning what the polity of the PCA is.
Okay, so this was sent to the presbyteries then. This was passed.
This will go to the presbyteries.
Yeah. Okay.
It was passed, I think I have the, it was passed 1427 to 481.
And, pretty good majority there.
Someone says in the chat, how about pastoress?
Shepherdess. I've heard of some churches doing that,
Well, there's even, you know, I've come across some, and they're few and far between, but, you know, even like their youth director, you know, will be called the youth pastor, and he's not ordained. Well, I don't think they should be referring to him as the youth pastor, because we have an office of elder pastor. Yeah. So it just confuses things.
So someone in chat is saying that he's seen in the PCA advisors who are unordained women that attend the session meetings that are on the elders page of a website. I don't know what he's referring to.
Yeah, I've heard of this kind of thing. I don't know if this would address that, but I don't think that's a good practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have in channel Jason Whitaker, who is a PCA member, I believe. And I'm going to have him join. Hey, Jason, can you hear us?
I can hear you perfectly. Hey, John, how are you?
Oh, you have a better mic than me. This is crisp and clear. So, yeah, everyone should subscribe to your YouTube channel, Dear Woke Christian, haven't, on YouTube and I'm sure other social media outlets. So, Jason, you've been here since the beginning of our stream, and you are in the PCA, right?
That is correct. I am actually a deacon. I'm an ordained deacon in the PCA, and thankfully my church does not confuse the pool by having deaconesses or assistants. I think it was you, Sean, that said it's very confusing. I can only imagine, like, wait, my wife could be a deaconess, but I assist. Am I a deacon? Like, I can already see that problem coming up pretty quick and fast just with that example alone. If a woman could be an assistant, she could be a deaconess. But if a guy is an assistant, is he a deacon? Like, that would just cause so many problems that, yeah.
Is it PCA? I mean, I'm ignorant on this, I guess, but is it a PCA kind of in their doctrine that, like, I guess, gunekos, the women who have these service or have these requirements that they have to meet in order to serve, that they're not deaconesses, that they're, is there an office for that? Or what category is that?
So at my church, Smyrna Presbyterian, we don't have any of these extra roles. So there might be a lead, for example, the children's ministry. She's a lead, the young lady that's responsible for the children's ministry, and she oversees the childcare during Sunday morning as well as Sunday evening worship as well as on Wednesdays. I think she's called a director. I apologize. I think she might be called the children's director. But by no means is anybody confusing her with a role of the ecclesiastical role. We have several pastoral interns in our church that we support from RTF. They have pastoral intern roles, but nobody's called a pastor, deacon, associate pastor, minister, anything else, unless, of course, they have been ordained to do so.
Well, I'm trying to understand, like, in light of 1 Timothy 3:11, right, where it's talking about qualifications for deacons, and then it just pops in the middle with, in the same way, the women must be dignified, not slanderers, but temperate and faithful. I mean, does the PCA take this as these are the wives of deacons, or what group is that?
I'll let you go, Zach.
Yeah, I don't think there's any official interpretation there. I mean, there's some people who say that those are deacons, right? Mm-hmm. That some people make that argument that these are female deacons. The PCA definitely rejects that interpretation, which leaves the two options. They're either the wives of deacons, and they're mentioned because they would be serving with their husbands, the deacons, right, or they're just women assisting the deacons. And of course, I think we can all agree we need women, you know, serving in, sure, in some capacity in the church. And so the PCA has this provision, but it's not limited to women. So it's men, male or female assistants to the deacons. So that's how they would. So it leaves open one of those two options, essentially. But yeah, I think it's a good practice that we have these assistants. I think, you know, churches should take advantage of it, and I don't think they always do. But
yeah, I can see why you think this is I didn't think it was going to be controversial, really, when you brought it up, because I knew where you were going a little bit. But I can see within the PCA, I mean, I already have people are weighing in, like, here's Matthew Fletcher. What about assistant pastor who is ordained? This is another PCA issue, actually. Now, there's, I mean, it's going to be a mess here if, you know, we keep talking about, like, what titles are appropriate for different genders and what capacities they fill. I mean, everyone is in agreement that the role of pastor and the title pastor is reserved for men. But I guess it gets muddier when it comes to the deacons issue.
Well, part of it also is, you know, we have a constitution, our mm-hmm. church. We have a standard. And currently our constitution says the officers of our church are men, elder and deacon. So to me, the issue, the theological question is important, and we can have that debate. But the way to go about that is to actually implement a change in our constitution, not try to go around the issue. And it's almost like, how much of the line can I cross before I'm actually violating the BCO?
Correct.
Interesting. I think that's part of the issue. I mean, you know, but the PCA has taken a stance on that, and it's in our constitutional documents. So any church that is a part of our denomination needs to abide by that and not try to go around it. Or, you know, like in the case of not ordaining any deacons, just commissioning them, you're actually in violation of our BCO.
There you go.
You don't have any ordained deacons. Right. So those are some of the concerns that I think this is trying to mitigate.
Sean, it seems like some of these problems have just arisen over time. They were never really dealt with. And now you have this kind of diverse practice in the PCA.
Yeah.
Maybe you've seen that too, Jason.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's kind of messy. I think our BCO is clear, but this overture is aimed at trying to deal with some of that. I'll mention one other thing, John, because you had a question about the assistant pastor. So the way the PCA works, we have pastor, you can also have associate pastor or assistant pastor. So this gets a little right. confusing. They're all teaching elders. So pastor is a proper term for them. Associate pastor is just another pastor who's on the session. The reason assistant pastor is controversial is because he's not on the session. He's appointed by the session. And so he's a teaching elder, but not on the session. He doesn't get a vote. So some people argue, well, that's not biblical. I'm not going to get into that now, but you can see where that has some controversy. So
was that the other, I know there was one other thing you wanted to mention, and I know we need to land the plane here soon. Cause we've been going over an hour. Was there another overture?
Oh yeah. There was one more good one.
Zach, why don't you get into the petition? This is the one you were asking about, John, earlier.
Okay.
So this is actually, I think, one of the best things the General Assembly did here in 2023 is Overture 12. And this will not go to the presbyteries. This is a done deal because it's a petition. So you just needed over 50% of the assembly, and it's done. So there was the original, this is on transgender surgeries. The original overture had specific language for a letter to be sent to government officials condemning transgender surgeries, especially on minors. But what the Overtures Committee did is they sent this to the they recommended that the moderator, who's was Fred Greco, appoint a commission to write the letter. So we don't actually know what the letter is going to look like, but it does have to condemn the practice of surgical and medical gender reassignment procedures, especially for minors. So it must do that. We don't know what it'll look like in the details, but it must do that. And that's to be sent to, I think, basically all the federal government, Senate, House, President, Supreme Court. And then I think it's recommended to be that, that presbyteries send it to their state governments. So, I mean, I think this is huge. I think, you know, transgender surgeries are a terrible thing, and they're maiming the body and forever. It's terrible. And especially for minors, right? They're under 18. We don't even let them go buy alcohol or cigarettes or something, but hey, they can tell their mom they feel like they're the other sex. And so, you know, then the doctor will agree and everybody goes along and they're going to give them hormone blockers or worse, do surgery. I mean, this is terrible stuff. Right. I think so the debate was over whether this is permitted. The vote was, let's see if I have it here, 1,089 to 793. So it's somewhat close. And you had a fair amount opposed to it. I think those voting against it, their main argument was, look, we all condemn transgender surgeries, but we don't think this is something the church should necessarily speak to. And so this brings into brings us to Westminster Confession 31.4, which is, you know, the American version of the Confession 1787 and 88. Modified a couple things on civil government, but it did not modify this. It kept it. It says synods and councils are to handle or conclude nothing but that which is ecclesiastical, right? So with church, synods and councils should focus on church matters. And it says they are not to intermeddle with civil affairs which concern the commonwealth unless by way of humble petition in cases extraordinary. So that's the issue is, okay, normally the General Assembly should not get involved in civil affairs concerning the commonwealth. Everybody agrees with that. We shouldn't be doing these statements every year on everything. Does this qualify as a case extraordinary? And I think the answer is yes, it does. This is an extraordinary situation. It's a terrible evil. It's new, and it's something that must be condemned. Now, there was some pushback even by, there was an article by R. Scott Clark. He's not even in the PCA, but he was arguing against this. And he was arguing that case is extraordinary, only refers to...
I saw that.
Yeah. It must uniquely affect the church. I think his interpretation is completely wrong. He's citing A.A. Hodge, who's... Look, I like A.A. Hodge, but he wrote this in 1870. He's got no special insight into the Westminster Assembly unless he's quoting something from them. Clark even admitted, here's a quote, a survey of 17th century English Reformed writers from the period of the assembly suggests that it means something like highly unusual. Case is extraordinary. Yeah, that's what it means. Case is extraordinary. It's highly unusual. Right. So that's why we voted for this. So
yeah,
thanks to Scott Clark. So
sex transition is kind of unusual. I mean,
very much so.
Highly, actually. Yeah. Yeah, that's so strange. I actually thought about doing a podcast responding to that article when it came out. But thank you, Zach, for summarizing, because now I don't need to do that. It was so weird to me. And I
mean, here's the thing. The church in this case, the PCA is simply calling the government, the civil government, to do its job. That's all we're doing. We're saying protect children. And
right.
Protect everybody. Protect children. Punish evil. Romans 13:4. I mean, they're not doing their job. And so somebody's, if the church never does this stuff, especially in our day and age where the civil government's totally out of line and complete rebellion against God, who's going to do it?
You know, Zach, I always thought, you know, if you went to all the divines at the assembly that wrote this document, by the way, mm-hmm. you asked them, hey, you know, do you think it's a case extraordinary? You know, the civil government right now is is cutting off children's genitals and mutilating children. I think this should be something that the church should prophetically speak to and tell them to stop doing it. I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone that would say, no, that's we're not to meddle in those affairs.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder what would be a highly unusual, like in the civil, like, is it cannibalism? Like, where's the line then? Like, you know, I guess not until they eat someone who's in the PCA that the PCA then has an interest. Well, by that
and remember, last year we petitioned the government to end abortion.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, I think you know, abortion is barbaric. It's horrific. I think you chalk this up right with it. You're mutilating children permanently. Right. I think, you know, because our culture is rebelling against the created order. Or we could say, you know what, God, I know you created me as a man, but I'm a woman. I feel like a woman. I mean, you know, talk about ultimate rebellion.
It's Romans 1. But yeah, John, that was the argument that I think prevailed. The reason this prevailed is people said, if we're not going to speak to transgender surgeries, especially on minors, what are we ever going to petition the civil government for?
Yeah.
And I think that's the point John was making. Like, okay, what is, in your mind, what is something that is, that would justify us speaking to it? If not abortion, if not mutilation of children, what could it be? I shudder to think what would actually get you to actually speak on it. So good point.
I'm glad. What is Clark, R. Scott Clark, part of, is if it's not the PCA?
He's URC, United Reformed Churches. They split off from the...
I can't keep this straight.
Christian Reformed Church. So here, I'll give it to you real quick. Okay. There used to be just one Dutch Reformed Church. Mm-hmm. I think it was 1850s. They split off into the Reformed Church in America, and which they're totally liberal today, and the Christian Reformed Church.
CRC, yeah.
Yeah, CRC. They're fairly liberal, but there's some conservative renewal. In 1995, they started allowing women pastors, and that's when a bunch of churches left and formed the URC, United Reformed Churches.
Okay. Gotcha. So, and that's not the one, oh goodness, what's his name now? I'm trying to remember his name. It's killing me that I can't remember, because I just had him on. You and I were talking about him, Zach, about Common Grace and stuff.
You know what I'm talking about. Yeah, and now I'm going to blank on him.
We're both blanking. This is great.
Dutch guys. Engelsma.
Engelsma,
And some of that history gets a little complicated because there were some debates and splits with the Dutch. So they differ on some theology there. I forgot his denomination's name. But
so that's a different one, though. Anyway, okay.
Yeah, it's different.
Well, we've gone an hour and 16 minutes. We should probably land the plane. Zach, Sean, thank you. Jason, thanks for coming in here at the end. And you can go subscribe. Yeah, subscribe to Jason's YouTube and follow Sean and Zach on Twitter. And we'll connect soon. And hopefully this will be an annual tradition, I guess, of what happened at the PCA. So thanks, guys.
Hey, you got it. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Take care.
Save big money and transform your home with new appliances now at Menards. We offer the lowest prices and the largest in-stock appliance selection ready to take home today. Check out top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Upgrade your home and save big money on new appliances at Menards. Shop our entire selection of appliance options online today at Menards.com. Save big money
at Menards. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.